If you hold a stone, hold it in your hand. If you feel the weight.
Dear listeners, my name is Catherine Hogg, and I'm a curator at the Kunsthaus Zurich, Switzerland. This podcast was released as part of the Ligia Clark retrospective at the Kunsthaus on view from November 14, 2025 to March 8, 26. The show was developed in cooperation with the Neue Nationalgalerie in Berlin and is the first comprehensive exhibition of the Brazilian artist's work in the German-speaking world. As a leading representative of neoconcretismo, Clark first expanded the image into space, then sculpture took on an increasingly strong connection to the body, until the representative and object-like artwork was finally abandoned altogether in the 1970s. To this day, Clark's objects and installations allow viewers to become active participants in an enlarged notion of the artwork. She herself said, "For me, creating art is about developing oneself as a human being, which is the most important thing of all. Art should not emulate any name or concept." Quote end. In this podcast series, contemporaries and specialists such as Alessandra Clark, Yvan Lambois and Irene Small shed light on the great relevance of Clark's work today. Enjoy listening.
Hello, I'm Elise Mazadiego, art historian and professor at the University of Bern, and I'm joined by Irene B. Small, professor at Princeton University, art historian and specialist in contemporary art, whose research focuses on Brazil. Her first book, published in 2016, was a monographic study on the artist Elio Gisica, and today we are discussing the recent publication of her second book titled The Organic Line, Toward a Topology of Modernism, published last year by Zone Books. Irene, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you, Elise.
In the introduction to your book, you describe the genre of this book as a paramonograph, referring to the ways it centers on the Brazilian artist Ligia Clark's work and uses one of her key concepts, the organic line, as a tool to examine modern and contemporary art practices. Could you explain to our listeners what is the organic line?
Yes. So the organic line is actually a line of space, a kind of gap between things, right? That Ligia Clark first observed in 1954. And this happens in the midst of her making a collage. So she has a collage she's making with cardboard pieces, and she has this sort of framing mat where she's moving around these pieces. And she notices that when she moves one of these cardboard pieces next to the mat, which happens to be the same color and is also made of cardboard, a line of space remains between these two material elements. And then she begins to notice this line of space also exists between a painting and its frame, for example, but also elsewhere. So between doors and lintels or tiles on the floor. And in fact, if you look around you right now, you'll begin to see organic lines just about everywhere. So Clark names this interval of space the organic line, and she begins to use it as a structuring principle for her work. So, for example, rather than draw a line on the continuous surface of a canvas, she starts to fit these plaques of wood together so that the surface of the work actually has fissures of space. So the organic line comes to inform her subsequent practice as an artist, her interest in voids, for example, the notion of the empty full, and even her much later therapeutic experiments in which she's thinking about the patient or the client in terms of a kind of psychic or bodily schema that can be manipulated in order to move around or suture gaps or fractures that are experienced by the subject. So that's a quite kind of radical implication of the organic line. But what I think is interesting is that even in the earliest discovery of the organic line in the mid-1950s, there are very radical implications. So remember that the organic line is formed by actual space. So in other words, the space within a work of art, what might initially read like a graphic line, for example, is actually continuous with the space in which we, the viewers, encounter that same work. So the organic line forms a continuity with the entire envelope of space in which we exist, in which we move and experience and so forth. And I think this might actually be the best way to understand why Clark calls the line organic. The organic line is not a kind of wavy or curvilinear or biomorphic line. It's organic in the sense that it is formed naturally by intervals of space between joined elements, and it organically connects to the space of the world in which we live. So we could call it a living space.
Now you've kind of described the way that this organic line figures in her work. And I would also like to discuss then to what extent you expand on this concept to then begin to kind of apply it as a tool within your book. Your book offers kind of a historical reading based on archival material and then a speculative reading. And so maybe you could discuss these two parallel investigations, explaining why you depart from a kind of traditional historical study of Lydia Clark and what she's doing with the organic line in her practice, and then how you expand beyond that.
Sure. So when I first started on this research, I wanted to understand why it was that Clark noticed the organic line at the time that she did. Since organic lines always exist around us, right, what were the historical and intellectual and aesthetic conditions that led her to recognize this line of space in 1954, and perhaps more importantly, name it, right, and begin to use it in her work? Now, what's interesting is that she discovers the organic line in 1954, but she doesn't really name it or publicly discuss it until 1956. So this period between 1954 and 1956 is a really critical period of gestation, we could say, in which she's trying to understand it and explore its implications, test it out vis-a-vis other kinds of marks and distinctions as they pertain to the materiality of surfaces and planes. So at an archival level, I really wanted to understand conditions of possibility, and I really kind of focused a lot of my archival research looking very carefully at those 2 years and the time period leading up to and immediately after. The second sort of more speculative aspect of the organic line that you mentioned concerns what I would call its use value. And what I mean by this is the fact that I believe the organic line is an incredibly powerful conceptual tool. Right. It's a tool we can use to describe other kinds of practice or phenomena that lie really beyond the purview of Lydia Clark's own work or even her kind of historical trajectory as an artist working from, you know, the 40s through the 80s. So how might attending to channels of space compel us to rethink certain works of art or artistic theories? The notion of deductive structure or framing edge in Frank Stella's stripe paintings, for example, or the ways in which the composer John Cage demarcated or sort of designated containers of silence. And, you know, this more speculative aspect or kind of application of the organic line as a concept means that I think we can also use it to discuss contemporary practice. So how might an artist dilate or concretize a political or social interval between the institution of the museum and the public space of the street, for instance? Or how might we pay attention to gaps within the supposed continuity of, you know, a given archive or narrative or history? You know, for me, the really fascinating thing about the organic line is that it is a phenomenon that already exists, right? It has always existed, but we don't notice it until someone calls our attention to it. So if we think about the organic line in this way, it's really a mechanism for attention. Right? It's a way to defamiliarize what we think we already know, and perhaps more importantly, what we already see, what we think we already see.
Once the listener actually looks at the book, they will see that you sort of begin with Lydia Clark and then really start to give your attention to all these other different artists that are potentially linked to her and potentially not. And we'll discuss that to some degree in this conversation. One aspect that you're mentioning about your book is really how your approach potentially can have us rethink what modernism is and the global modernism in which Ligia Clark emerges. And so perhaps you could speak to how your approach potentially displaces a common trope in modernism, which is the unilateral flow of influence and origin from the global north to the global south.
Yeah, so I actually see this as quite related to the way the organic line works at a cognitive level, right? That we don't notice it, but once we do, it's very apparent and we start to see it everywhere. So when I first started thinking about the organic line and what I felt were its really far-reaching implications as a formal device, the analogies I could make were to other key concepts in modernist art history, like the ready-made or the collage or the monochrome. And these are all inventions that are considered so foundational and influential that they changed the course of modern art. So how could you imagine 20th century art without Duchamp turning a urinal into a work of art, for example, or Malevich painting a black square and utterly eliminating figuration? So in each of these cases, and of course there are many more, we can chart a history of influence. So we know Jasper Johns saw Duchamp's work in 1957 and began to make sculptures of everyday objects like light bulbs or flashlights. Soon after, the Soviet artist Elisitsky really internalized the lessons of Malevich's black square. He painted three monochromes in red, yellow, and blue and declared that painting was over. So, you know, in each of these cases, what we're doing is not only tracing direct influence, we're charting a kind of upping of the ante, right? And this is fundamental to the way in which we tell the history of modern art itself. Now, the organic line, I would argue, and this is, you know, part of what I do argue in the book, the organic line is as foundational as these other devices in terms of its conceptual implications. But it's very different from these other devices because it only had direct influence within Clark's much smaller circuit of artists and critics in Brazil. So her work never gained the kind of international recognition or notoriety that Duchamp's or Malevich's did in their own lifetimes. And both the sort of geopolitics and the gender of Clark's identity are not incidental to this distinction. So if in a kind of more traditional art history, we might trace something like the influence of, let's say, you know, Cubist collage from Paris in the teens to Russia or India or Mexico, again, charting a kind of influence or what before in your question you called unilateral spread, directionality, the organic line presents a very different problem, right? How do you narrate a history of a modernist device that has been all but absent from canonical modernist history? And moreover, how can something like the organic line, which is a discovery made by a so-called peripheral or a once peripheral artist like Clark, have a reciprocal effect on the center, on the historical canon that we know?
This is then really important when we're talking about Ligia Clark and the way in which she's been historicized and the way in which Brazilian neoconcretism has been historicized, which listeners will probably see in the retrospective at the Kunsthaus Zurich and also at the Haus Konstruktiv, which is also having a parallel exhibition, which offers a glimpse at the Swiss artist Max Bill and his relationship to Brazilian neoconcretism and specifically Ligia Clark. And for art historians like yourself and for myself, the kind of education that I received really did frame Ligia Clark's artistic development in relationship to Max Bill. And so I was wondering, what would you say is the traditional narrative of Bill and Clark's relationship? And then how does your book afford a new perspective on this subject?
Okay, so yes, you know, this, as you mentioned, the relationship between Bill and Clark is what we could say almost a kind of classic example of how a traditional story of European influence and a kind of local Latin American response might unfold. Now, Max Bill very famously won a prize for sculpture at the first Sao Paulo Biennale in 1951. And not incidentally, this sculpture demonstrated the topological character of the Mobius strip. So the Mobius strip is a single-sided loop, and it's important for mathematics because it shows the kind of continuity, right? That's the topological phenomenon, have continuity amongst all their parts. And for Bill, the Mobius strip embodied a kind of marriage of mathematics and art. Now, Bill also had a retrospective in Sao Paulo around this time. And as a result of these events and various visits and publications, he did come to Brazil and meet with artists, including Clark, much later, that is. Bill and his notion of concrete art more broadly really became a point of reference for many young artists in Brazil who were experimenting with geometric abstraction at the time. As Brazilian concretism split and developed into Brazilian neoconcretism in the later 1950s, many of the kind of rationalist theorems that were associated with Bill were critiqued and revised. So artists like Eliot Sica, Ligia Pape, and of course Ligia Clark all reimagined the sort of permanent and monumental character of Bill's Mobius strip sculpture, which, you know, stayed there in Brazil. You can see it to this day. They reimagined this kind of monumental sculpture in terms of flexible and tactile, ephemeral, and ultimately social configurations. So in this vein, Clark's work Caminhando, which means sort of walking or meandering or trailing, this is a work in which a participant cuts a Mobius strip made out of paper until it becomes a mere tangle of threads. And this is an example of what the art historian and friend of Ligia Clark, Yves Lambois, has called a strong misreading of Bill's sculpture. In other words, it's a way of reacting against a dominant influence in order to get out from under that influence, and in this sense, arrive at something new. So this notion of a kind of, you know, the Brazilian artists in neoconcretism making a strong misreading of this European rationalist formulation, this is a very compelling reading, and it's also one that is supported by certain narratives of the Brazilian artists and critics themselves. There is no question, no doubt at all, that Bill's presence in Brazil brought attention to notions of topology, the idea of concrete art, and so forth. However, when I was researching those conditions of possibility for Clark's discovery of the organic line, I was struck by the fact that she was actually in Paris and not in Brazil in 1951. That critical year. She was there from 1950 to 1952. So the critical years in which Bill's exhibition and sculpture were in view. And for this reason, I think it's very likely that her first exposure to the notion of concrete art was in fact not Bill's mathematical and very rationalistic formulation, but rather these much more organic and mineralogical metaphors that were being put forward by Hans Arp. And Arp's formulations had quite wide circulation in Paris at the time that she was there. And what's important here is that I'm not trying to sort of switch one influence for another. You know, it's not that I want to replace Bill with Arp. Clark and Arp do seem to have been aware of one another. It seems that he came to her exhibition in Paris in 1952. And some years later, she actually sent him one of her bichos, which are these manipulable sculptures. But Arp never really rises to the level of what I would call an influence in the strong sense of the term. His work and his theories have a much more oblique relation to Clark's, even if I find them more sort of philosophically and aesthetically resonant than those of Bill. Now, because the organic line is also a kind of oblique or submerged relation, right? It's not a line so much as a non-line, a void. I became interested in what it would mean to write an art history, not simply of strong links, right? Clark's creative and interpretations or strong misreadings of Bill or Mondrian, for example, but rather how to write an art history that attends to these weaker links or these missed connections, these lateral relations like Arp and Clark, or even Clark and Stella, who never knew each other at all. So in my book, I call these kinds of oblique relations plagiotropic, and this draws from a botanical term that refers to a kind of lateral branching of plants or the positionality of the branch or the plant in relation to a stimulus like the sun. And I find this notion of the plagiotropic incredibly generative because sometimes an oblique or lateral orientation can open up a set of possibilities that would otherwise be invisible if you only look for, say, you know, the smoking gun. And I think this goes, you know, as much for artistic practice as it does for art historical research.
Yeah, and in your book, there's a lot of illustrations that help the reader to see what it is that you're talking about. And I would say that in the case of the plagiotropic, you have this really beautiful illustration reproduced in the book that shows the kind of spatial dimension of this paradigm. I think what this offers is a way of rethinking modernism and also rethinking the research and the work that art historians do in terms of drawing connections, charting certain kinds of networks of affiliation and influence and engagement that has a different shape now. And that really has implications for how we look at the past, how we can rethink the past. But I think for many art historians, we want our students and the readers of our work to also understand the relevance of the past on the present. So how do you see Clark's concept of the organic line resonating with today, either in relation to contemporary art or in much broader terms?
Yes, thank you for that. So yeah, I do see the book as really kind of moving across chronologies. In one way, we could say it's a kind of contemporary history of modern art, but we could also say that it's a way of thinking modernism's use value for the present, right? So I wanted to show, you know, the ways in which Clark's concept might inform contemporary practices in a descriptive capacity or as a kind of analytic tool. And in the book, I discuss a number of contemporary artists. I talk about Cameron Rowland, Mikhail Riedel, Adam Pendleton, Ricardo Bosbaum, the Brazilian collective Frentistas de Fevereiro. Mika Rottenberg, who's a video artist based in New York, might be a good example of some of the ways we might see the contemporary resonance of the organic line in a very different context. So as I mentioned before, one of Clark's first revelations about the organic line was in relationship to architecture, right? So the fissures between doors and their frames. Of course, you know, without that gap, you can't open the door. But as we all know, doors also can stick, right? They swell, they can gape, they can sag. In other words, their joins or sort of joints don't always align perfectly with the connecting surfaces or frames. And it's, in fact, this kind of fissure where, say, the geometric precision of an architectural drawing comes up against the variability of actual materials and embodied usage that we really see the organic line in action. And Clark was very attuned to these kinds of concretized and embodied spatial intervals. And as her practice developed, her engagement with architecture became increasingly errant and dissident and corporeal. So initially, we're talking about, you know, cabinets and doors, and, you know, soon we're talking about the porosity and elasticity of skins and vaginal canals and interior topologies and so forth. So in Mika Rottenberg's video works, I find these a kind of corporealized and very fantastical architecture that is then mapped onto global flows of labor and production. So she conjures these sort of fantastical ligations between, say, a wholesale market for kitsch plastics in China and a network of underground tunnels beneath the U.S.-Mexico border. And she, of course, she can do this by virtue of the video cut, the filmic cut, which you could think of as a kind of organic line in and of itself. She's also using actors and ways of thinking about size and singularity and specificity to exaggerate the idiosyncrasies of bodies as they interact with these architectures and networks. So she's calling attention to the interstices of global connection, and she's thickening these channels. She's making them sort of lumpy and strange. And as she's doing this, she's disturbing the idea that global movement is either sort of seamless or bodiless. So like Clark, she's materializing and corporealizing interstices and gaps that are otherwise illegible or go unnoticed. But in this case, they pertain directly to our global entanglement and our kind of interdependency. And I guess I would say that for me, this is also one of the important takeaways of the organic line as an analytic tool, right? It can help us describe aesthetic phenomena like the behavior of space in relation to material elements, but it can also describe political phenomena. So the way the very notion of the border here in the United States is being dilated and multiplied through practices of detainment and transnational incarceration. So that's just one of the examples that's front and center for me right now. But what I think is important here is that the organic line gives us a kind of vocabulary with which to attend to boundaries and apertures and gaps of all kinds. And these can be used, right, for good and for bad. The important thing is to attend to them, to understand how they work, right? And this is why at the end of the book, I conclude with a kind of invitation to the reader, right, to find distinctions like the organic line, to dilate their liminality, and to think about the reciprocal effects that occur as these spaces are formed and reformed over time.
Well, I think that really explains then the larger import of Ligia Clark's organic line and the diversity of your book and the various perspectives that you offer, both historical and contemporary. And I think this is probably a good place to end. So thank you, Irene, for this conversation and for sharing some insights. I think your publication arrives at a wonderful moment, offering another perspective on Clark's work and particularly the retrospective at the Kunsthaus Zurich, which most of our listeners will be tuning into. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Hold it in her hand. If you feel the weight, money is off. You'll never be late, money is off.
This podcast series was conceived by Katrin Hoog and produced by Kim Stengel, with a song dedicated to Ligia Clark by Gaetano Veloso from 1971. We would like to thank the speakers, further also Christiane Klutz and Klaus Kovacs, as well as the directors of the respective institutions and the minister for the Kunsthaus Zurich and Klaus Biesenbach for the Neue Nationalgalerie. Copyrights are with the Zürcher Kunstgesellschaft and the speakers.
Para ser feliz, cadê meu sol dourado? E cadê as coisas do meu país?